Good morning.
Good morning.
And good morning. So, this morning I want to talk a little bit more about what I was talking about last week with the Wizard of Oz, but I'm not going to be redundant. So, but I want to start off with the question that pervades Buddhist teaching and pervades the teaching of the Vedas too. I'm going to wait until Judy comes in and finds a seat, or finds a seat back there or something. Okay. And somebody else too. The who am I question. The who am I question. Which really predates Buddha. He was raised in an environment where that was the big question, the who am I question, and of course it's still a big question for people who practice. Are we our perceptions? Are we our emotions? Are we our sensations? Are we our memory? Certainly our memory. Are we our beliefs? Who are we? If none of that, at least this body, the self seems to be in a body. It seems to be in a body that's been with us for a long time. But we know that the body, every 7 years, all the molecules are replaced. So in a 7-year period, all new molecules. So, who are we? And who are we at home when we're trying to take care of our daily life chores? Who are we when we're at Zen Center? We're trying to tap into some wonderful stillness like Leo presented with us this morning. Oh, Leo, what were you playing this morning?
The first piece was a short piece called Takanasashi, which has something to do with harvesting bamboo. The second piece I started was a lot longer piece. It was called Sanya, which means three valleys. Uh-huh. And because of time constraints, I could play the first valley too long.
I see. So, harvesting bamboo. And what's the true nature of your bamboo nature? Is it hollow in the middle? Or is it full of stuff? So, according to Buddha's thought, the sense of self is created in two ways. One, we have an experience and we take it as mine. We have a lot of experiences, but an experience is mine. On Friday, I was at lunch with my staff that I work with at my other agency, and they were doing one of these things where you tell things about yourself that nobody knew, right? It's to break, to open things up and get people talking, right? So, I was sort of paying attention, kind of not paying attention. Then, a woman who works just in the same building, not that far from me, said she was from California. And immediately, that's my experience. I'm from California. She's from California. We have a bond because we're both from California. And there's the my coming up, right? I identify with that. I identify with that experience. Comes up very, very fast. And with Dorothy, as you remember from last time, Dorothy identifies with, in the beginning, I'm an orphan. I live in this bleak environment of you know the state, right? Kansas. This bleak environment with these dour foster parents, and all I have is my dog. But the dog is mine, and being an orphan is mine too. So we do that, right? That's how we create self. And then the second way in which we do it is that then we good or bad it, right? We compare it. Well, I'm from California. You guys are probably from North Dakota or Kansas or something. I'm from California. I'm just an orphan. I bet you grew up in a happy home. So we compare. And then that begins to solidify self, right? Through memory, through repeating to ourselves in conscious and unconscious ways, over and over again we do this. Better, worse, equal. Well, maybe Hawaii is equal to California. Maybe I'll hang out with you. You know, we always were doing this. Always were doing this. We're not even aware of it. And yet the who am I exploration is meant to see the me in each of these, and dismantle it by seeing that it's just a thought. It's just a bunch of thoughts together. So that at the time of Buddha, there was already a practice, the neti neti practice, N-E-T-I, N-E-T-I practice, which was the not this, not this, whenever the mind came up. Not this. Not this, not this. And he would have grown up in a culture where he learned that the not this, not this led to lightening up, to freedom, to happiness. At least we think that. You know, we don't really know, but that's what we think. But paradoxically, and those of you who've been doing Buddhism for a while, you know, you realize this. Paradoxically, we need healthy ego development. We need healthy, and Buddhism doesn't talk too much about that. But it must be implicit. I mean, it has to be implicit because we need it. I have a 9-month-old grandson and a 4-year-old grandson. Well, I watched my 4-year-old grandson go from 6 months to 4 years and begin to develop, begin to separate from his mom, begin to realize he can't get everything from his mom. And when he can't get everything, then he begins to develop a separate self. A separate self that learns to cope with frustrations because mama isn't there. So I have to use memory. I have to use crying. I have to use problem solving and then language. And my 4-year-old has got his language down to get his needs met. So we do that. We do that. And that's important. That's important. So if we just focus on one side of this equation and don't do the middle way, we forget how important that is. Again, at my other job, my Monday through Friday job, I'm director of a big agency with a lot of staff, and I had to select 2 people recently to manage, because I'm supposed to be doing other things besides managing, which I won't get into. I will get into going to the governor's office and creating a ruckus. That's what I'm supposed to be doing. I need to be doing that. I need to be doing that with this governor. You know, I wanted to select the best people possible. And so I had a psychologist do psychological profiles on a bunch on the last candidates. A lot of testing, an interview, and what am I trying to learn? I learn a lot from those. Those of you who've actually gone through this or who're psychologists yourself, you a tremendous amount. And I learn about their resiliency. I learned about their confidence. I learn about their ability to be team players. I learn about their ability to be visionaries and yet be detail-oriented. I learn all that stuff. That's ego. And I want the people, and I select the people. I selected the people who did the best, not just on the interview, but really on the even more on the psychological profiles, because people can fake it in the interview. They can fake it. Interviewing is a very poor predictor of performance. Very poor. So, ego We need ego. We need to take care of ego. On the one hand, and on the other hand. I'll come back to on the other hand. So let's look at Dorothy. Let's come back to Dorothy again. So Dorothy had her cyclone experience, right? She had her tornado experience. Well, during that tornado experience, her normal ego self was totally blown away. Totally disoriented. Her sense of confidence, her sense of everything, totally blown away. And then she was plunked down in this strange but beautiful land where everything was in technicolor. And the Witch of the North then reached out to her, the good witch, two good witches, there's the Witch of the North, and there's Glinda the Good. In the beginning, Witch of the North helps her. Toward the end, Glinda the Good helps her. These mentors that we all need. We all need mentors. We need supports. We need spiritual friends. And she puts her on the road, on the path. She doesn't put her. She just says, there it is. And she's scared at first. She's an orphan. She's in a disoriented area. All she has is Toto, her dog. That's her only remnant of her healthy self that she has, is Toto, her dog. But that's something. That's something. And she goes on the journey. And she gets stronger. Her sense of self gets stronger as she goes along. The Tin Woodman comes and he doesn't have a heart. So Dorothy develops her heart to support him so they can work together. The Cowardly Lion comes and he doesn't have courage, so she develops courage. The Scarecrow comes, who has no intelligence, and she develops intelligence. So, and they have lots of adventures, and bad things happen to them, but she develops healthy ego along the path. It helps her stay on the path. Nevertheless, from the Buddhist point of view, she's still dependent on what we call the fictional self. But that's an important fiction. Important fiction. Crucial fiction. Maybe better even not to call it a fiction, because that's kind of disparaging. People would rather read historical novels, but fiction? Ah. But is there really any difference, you guys? Is there really any difference? So, Buddha says, at least in the Nikayas, supposedly Buddha said, right? We don't know. Nikayas, Buddha said, monks, these things which are constantly changing, are they yourself? No, replied the monks. Monks, these bodily experiences which are continually changing, are they yourself? No, replied the monks. Monks, these feelings and perceptions which are constantly changing, are they yourself? No, reverend sir. These changing states of consciousness, are they yourself? No. Reverend sir, all these are found to be selfless. So we have these two teachings. And if we think of the no-self teaching as letting go of sticking to things, it's not quite so scary. It's just letting go of sticking to things. Letting go of sticking to California. North Dakota. To orphan. To good parents. Letting go of sticking to that stuff. So what does self include? What does it include? And I think it includes a few things. It includes role, right? It includes self-image. It includes identification with a group. This morning before I came over here, I was looking at the New York Times, the Sunday New York Times, and the front page of the arts section, there's Meryl Streep. Now, Meryl Streep, if we could behave like Meryl Streep in our daily lives, we'd all, like she does on stage, we'd all be Zen masters. Do you know why? No trace. She just puts herself into the role, completely becomes what is, and then leaves it behind. Now, we don't know what she's like at home. But we do know that she has that Naga-like ability, that chameleon-like ability, that Nagarjuna-like ability to completely enter without sticking to an identity, a previous identity. Just become what it is. And then become what it is the next time. If you saw her as Julia Childs, and then you remember her as in Sophie's Choice, my goodness, who is the there? Who is the self there? Wonderful, huh? Wonderful example. So my wife says to me at home sometime, "I'm not your staff. I'm not your staff." She needs that sometimes because I got stuck. These roles are our identity. I'm the head of some. I'm the head of this organization. I'm two heads. I'm a head. Two big heads. Well, I need my wife to say, "Come on, do the dishes. Do your share." Right? So we identify with roles. Roles are what we can hang on to. How we can feel solid in a world that's not solid. But we can also, through our Zen practice, develop this flexibility, this malleability of the Naga. And you know, chameleon, that has a negative connotation in our culture. But Naga, the serpent god, the dragon god, in Buddhism and Hinduism, nothing negative about that. Because it's just being with what is, just moving with what is. So Dorothy lets go of her role as a helpless orphan and develops some confidence. She's on the path for a while, and she gets into the blissed out in the poppy fields. Interesting that they chose. I was saying to someone the other day, interesting they chose poppy fields, isn't it? Totally blissed out in the poppy fields. But then she lets go of that poppy field high, and finally she comes back to the road, and even lets go of the idea that this little girl is too weak to kill the Wicked Witch of the West. And then even lets go the fact that there's a wise being who can save her. We always think there is some wise being somewhere who can save us. But she lets go of that. And then she returns home. Then we return home. So, self-identity, self-includes role, includes self-image. We talk about self-image in Zen, right? A lot. When I was my first years of practicing, when I was a little bit fanatic, I put a towel over my mirror because I had this little tiny room, and there was this huge mirror in my room. And it, for me, since I was always checking to see if I was doing well, by putting a towel over my mirror, I was saying, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm not going to get messed up with self-image. I'm just going to do one thing and then another thing. But of course, it didn't work. It didn't work. And people came over and said, "What's that towel on your mirror?" And then I was embarrassed. But self-image. Self-image. People give talks on Sundays. The people who are in training to be teachers give talks when I'm not here. And last year, one of them came up to me after he'd given his talk, and he said, then the next day, I guess, in Doksan, and he said, "You know, nobody said anything." He said, "How do I know if I'm doing okay or not?" And I said, well, you could have taken a poll. He said, oh, that would be embarrassing. You're just teasing me. Self-image. Self-image, right? Always comparing how we're doing. Always worrying. Always anxious about it. And then we try to block it out with some towel or some, I'm just going to do this. And it comes sneaking back in the back door, doesn't it? The side door. Pema Chodron says, being preoccupied with self-image is like coming upon a tree of singing birds while wearing earplugs. That's pretty good, isn't it? So role, self-image, and then member of a particular ethnic group, a particular class, a particular sangha, a particular family, a particular lineage. Be careful. Identity, right? We identify. And there are lots of examples of that. Lots of examples. I'm just trying to think whether I should give an example or not. But I will give an example. When I was in college, I joined a fraternity. I didn't last very long because of the counterculture was coming along. But before the counterculture came along, I joined a fraternity. And I hadn't thought about this fraternity in years and years and years until I was working on looking at the transmission ceremony to transmit the first and second person I'm going to be working with to become independent teachers. And I look at that ceremony, and I saw, oh, I looked at what was involved, and this reminded me of my fraternity initiation. I have to say that. And I had blown that off when I was 21. I said, that's ridiculous. That's complete. All these secret symbols that nobody knows, that everybody copies, that we had to copy and memorize using the Greek. You know, we were all Greek, right? Well, maybe you guys weren't in fraternities or sororities. There weren't any sororities at my college, just fraternities. And I thought, here we go. Here's identity. Here's how you can get fixated on your group. These are secret. These are special. I'm passing on something. Mind to mind, passed on from the time of Buddha. This is our Zen mythology. It's fine, but let's be light about it. Let's not be like fraternity people about it. And then we think that we've got it and other people don't have it, and that becomes our identity. And why are all these religious wars? Isn't that what it's about? Isn't that what it's about? So we need to be careful. So now I'm thinking, how can I do this with these folks in a way that's open, that's not exclusive, that's inclusive? How can I respect the tradition? Because I want to respect it, and still not to be too a sort of mumbo jumboish about it, as if this is some special language that isn't available to other people because they haven't sat for 10,000 hours or something. But of course, in Buddhism, we say that it's not only the roles, not only the self-image, not only identification with ethnicity or group. That bring up the idea of self, but it's our very nature that we think is solid, and it's not. It's our very nature that the Timness to thing to my life, the Davidness to your life, the Benness to your life. It's that stuff in there that makes us feel like we're one continuous being. Time magazine in 2002 said, brain researchers have concluded that there is no place for a self in the brain and it simply does not exist. Wow, so much for brain. brain researcher. Right? But anyway, it's interesting. And Ram Dass, after he had his really bad stroke, remember, he was so incapacitated he couldn't talk at all for a while. And then when he first was able to talk, he said, "If I take my body to be who I am really in trouble. I am really in trouble." So the experience of non-self, of letting go of all these layers of self, is a key part, or maybe the most important part of Buddhist practice. But we have to have enough of a resilient ego to engage in this practice. So we've got to take care of our ego, as Dorothy did, to engage in this. Really take care of it. Take care of it. Self is just a concept, ultimately. It's just a concept. And there can be an incredible freedom when you let go of it. And then, of course, you don't let go of it. It's just a letting go of it, just an opening. So, 2 or 3 years ago, in a retreat that we had down at Hokkyoji, one of the people there who was practicing with me had a wonderful opening, a wonderful awakening. And this person burst out crying. And people said, "Oh, she should come see me. She was having a really hard time." And then she came to see me, and she was not having a hard time. She was gone. And she was crying for all of the suffering that she had experienced with this fictional self. All of the worry, all of the comparing that she and others had experienced. She was crying in grief over that, in grief over how human beings do that over and over again. And then she went back into the Zendo, and this happened pretty much like this. Then a few the later in the day, someone came to me and said, "I was out doing Doksan. So-and-so is out of it," the same person, "out of it." I said, "Oh, how is she out of it?" And they said, "Well, she's left the Zendo and she's out in the field laughing." I said, "Oh, that's awful." I said, well, bring her in. So this was something like the fifth day of the retreat, the sixth day of the retreat, so he brought her in. And she said, "Well..." And I said, "Well, you know, you're bothering people in the Zendo." And she said, "Well, that's why I ran out of the Zendo. I didn't want to bother them. But I just feel so free. This weight is gone. This weight that I've carried around is like, it's gone completely. And everything is so alive. The trees, the grass, the sky. It's all alive." She said, "I can't help it. I'm in love." I'm in love. Well, that's the experience of no self. It's the experience of no self. Which happens when you practice. And of course, when you look for it, it doesn't happen. Of course it doesn't happen. Because then you're looking for something. Me looking for something. It doesn't happen. But it does happen. So in study group on Thursday, morning study group, we were talking about this self. Often I get my ideas. In study groups, I don't say anything. I just sit and listen. And I get ideas for my talks. So we were talking about this self. They were talking about this self. And somebody said, "Well, you know, just because there's no self doesn't mean that Buddhist teachers, that Buddhist teaching is negating experience. On the contrary, experience without a self is really alive. It's really dynamic. There's no critic, there is no comparison, and it's malleable and moving." So last time I talked about Dorothy's monkeys, didn't I? And they're not Dorothy's monkeys, remember? They're the wicked witch of the West monkeys. She's got her monkeys. She's got her team of monkeys who are trying to trying to terrorize Dorothy and her friends. They're terrorizing the monkeys. But what happens? When the Wicked Witch is dead, what happens? The monkeys no longer have the inner critic, no longer have the organizer, the Tim who's driving things, who's keeping those of you away who aren't satisfying me and pulling you, those of you in who are satisfying. So the monkeys, and Frank Baum, the author, was clear about that, are not bad. In the book, in his biography, he's clear. The monkeys are just monkeys. And when the Wicked Witch is dead, we just see the monkeys as monkeys. They have the life energy, the life force. Monkeys are inquisitive. Monkeys are curious. Monkeys enjoy everything. And if they're not at the, not led by some Wicked Witch of the West, some inner critic who's trying to prevail and conquer and live up to her self-image, then they're just monkeys. They come in, they come off, they swing, they try a banana, they try a papaya. That's the nature of human consciousness. So the Buddhist teacher Ajahn says, delusion is like a village terrorized by bandits. When ignorance dispels, the bandits no longer hold sway, and the whole village is free to go about its business undisturbed. So that's true. That's true. And you'll discover that, if you haven't already. So, caveats about this no-self thing. A couple more caveats about it. I've already suggested one or two, but a couple more caveats. One is, trying to be selfless, I don't recommend it. I mean, I really don't recommend it. Buddhists and Catholics and Lutherans and Muslims, I suppose, are all trying to be selfless. I don't recommend it. Why? Because you're creating a new image. My effort to be selfless. I want to do this, and if I accomplish this, then maybe I'll know no self. But actually, it gets very entangling. And Dorothy's strongest act, when was her strongest act? When was her real strength? When was the denouement? The denouement was, you know that word? Yeah, right. The denouement was when what? When she, unselfconsciously, not trying to do anything, with a still mind and an open heart, poured water on the scarecrow. Her friend, the scarecrow, was dying right there. And she poured water to save his life. But she wasn't trying to be selfless. She had a still mind. In that moment, she had a still mind and an open heart. And by doing that, she also killed the Wicked Witch of the West. She killed the inner critic. The witch died. Another caveat about this no-self thing is when we've been traumatized, when we feel shaky, when we feel fragile, it can bring up disorientation to say, not this, not this. Maybe we should say this, this instead. It's not so healthy. It doesn't really help us on the path. When we're in a depression, we need safety and balance, and then maybe we should not sit for hours a day, but just do some mindfulness retreats, which we have here, where there are other things going on, like work and yoga and not long sittings, because of the long sittings we may just sort of feed into that sense of hopelessness that's not Buddhist hopelessness at all. It comes from feeling that we've lost our confidence, that we've lost our way. So we should be careful about this. At the same time, I wouldn't say you shouldn't do a long retreat because I don't know. Sometimes people, I mean, I've had people with anxious depression, pretty bad, in this sangha, who've been on retreats, long retreats, and then done fine. So it's a little bit hard to calibrate, sort of case by case situation, I think. I mean, Jack Kornfield talks about a woman who went to a retreat that he was conducting, a 7-day retreat, who told him from the outset that she had anxiety and depression, anxious depression. And she came and went her first doksan with him. You know, doksan is the one-to-one that teachers have. I do that here every Sunday. So those of you who are interested, you can always sign up. I do that every Sunday. Anyway, during the retreat, she came in the first day, I guess at the end of the first day, and she was not doing well. She said, "Oh, the sitting facing this wall, I'm beginning to freeze. I'm beginning to think, who will I be if I lose myself? How will I operate in the world?" And he didn't suggest she leave the retreat or go to do the dishes. I probably would have suggested, well, maybe you should go do the dishes for a while. You work in the kitchen and make that your mindfulness and then come back and sit. But he didn't do that. He said, oh, just stay with it and try to be present with it. Just be present with it. Don't try to concentrate. Just be there with it gently. That was the end of the first day. And then the end of the fourth day, she came in and saw him. And she was feeling much better. And she said, on the previous break, she had just been sitting, just being present. And then she noticed that when the bell rang for the break, her body got up by itself and walked into the garden. And she was amazed. She was amazed. And the rest of the retreat, she was light. And her depression was lifted. Now, we better not suggest that her depression was permanently lifted. Some people have depression. Depression is built into their psyches. But for that time, it was lifted. It was lifted. So, and Dorothy, at the end, she lets go of the fictional self. She lets go of the fictional self. And she lets go of it when she doesn't need the wizard anymore to come home. She doesn't need anybody out there. And when she gets home, she experiences the same luminosity that she experienced in Oz, in this drab Kansas with this drab and dull Aunt Em and Uncle whatever his name was. The same luminosity. At least that's my interpretation. That's my interpretation. Connected to all beings. So connected to Oz, connected to Aunt Em, connected to Toto. So I'll finish with another quote from the Nikayas. "Therefore, monks, whatever experience, feelings, perceptions, thoughts you have, realize this does not belong to me. This I am not. This is not myself. And monks, that is the door to freedom." So that's what I want to say this morning. And if you have questions or comments, please proceed. Well, how do you think you do that?
Be aware of it.
Well, try to live a healthy life. Try to get enough sleep. Try to hang out with people who bring joy into your life. Try to take on projects that are fulfilling. When you have a lot of negative thoughts coming in, don't believe them. Do something else. Don't fight with them, but maybe be in therapy, but maybe not be in therapy. I don't know. I don't know. You really have to decide. What a therapist is doing is helping you discover some confidence, some ability just to have confidence and joy in your life. But in these days, lots of Zen people have therapists. I never had a therapist. I mean, my therapist was my wife and my milieu and reminding myself the path I was on. I tried it a couple times, but it was okay. But for some people, it's great. Very necessary. Very necessary. And some people, even after they become Zen teachers, need therapy. Maybe the time will come when I'll need therapy. Who knows? I'm open to it. What? Well, let's see. I'm not sure. I guess I'm confused. Can I?
Cynthia, let's go with
it. Is that helpful? Yeah. Is that helpful? Okay.
No, I just have a quick point. I just heard you with it about a little bit ago, and he talked a lot about what you were talking about today. He had a great line, and he said people who are attached to self, I can work with that, but people who are attached to no self, these are very good.
That's great. Another thing we know, and you guys know this, is that in the first few years of life, the most vital function is to develop attachment. And some people long into adulthood haven't developed the attachment they need to an early childhood. And that's so important. Even if you're 65 years old and you haven't developed that attachment, that's probably more important for you, since you didn't develop it at 3, than all this no-self stuff. Anything else? Yeah.
So when we make the self, we also make others.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a question about that relationship, or that perceiving and identifying fall with others.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know in the film in Dorothy Comes Back to Kansas,
uh-huh,
the lion was upon him with these people who had different roles.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you would speak about that, the like fluid to others.
Speak about the fluid other. I'm not sure what. Yes, the book and the movie are the same. Yes, in fact, yes, the cowardly lion. I mean, I can't remember what it is, but which of them becomes the? Some of them. One of them takes over farmland. Another one does something. Another one does something. So what's the point of that? One of the points is that when we loosen our ideas about what we need to be, and we give other people permission to loosen too. The very act of my being able just to be here with no particular agenda except just to be helps you just be, and then what is it? We don't know, but there's just some pleasure, there's just some intimacy in that fluidity. So the cowardly lion, he's a farmer. Was that the deal? I can't remember. and when we allow ourselves to be malleable, to take different roles without saying, "Oh, I'm not doing the dishes now. That's not my role." Other people feel that malleability too, and there's connection, there's intimacy. Now, I don't know if that's what you were asking about. Is that what you were asking about? Okay. Yeah.
I was thinking at the beginning of your talk, in Japan, in a business setting, the ritual is to hand your business card to the other party. And that defines your role, it defines your group.
Yeah.
It pretty much defines who you are.
Yeah.
And the first time I went to Japan in a business meeting, I went without business card.
Yeah.
And it was a, you were a non-self.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very good point. And the interesting thing about Japanese culture is that this focus on self-image and the focus on role and the focus on underneath self in Japan, the attachment, in Japan the limitations are a little different than this country. In Japan, it's group ego. And it's group ego that you have to become free from. And you can see that in the way we do things here. You know, you do things this way, not this way. Well, okay. Yes, we do. But come on. Come on. Let's relax a little bit. That's group ego. And that allowed Japan as an island in the middle of a small island to develop cohesiveness, to develop a sense of culture, and ultimately almost to take over the world. Right? That's a group ego. Well, we don't have too much group ego in this country, but we have a lot of individual ego. So when our Japanese teachers came, they were on us for our individual ego. And of course, we need ego, but it's interesting to see how different cultures manifest it in different ways. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have a story, something like that.
Okay.
I remember a Japanese teacher, after a long retreat, and he asked people, well, how did you do? And all his Western American students said, I felt calmer. You know, I did this. All of his Japanese students said, I'm going to be a better son. I'm going to be a better daughter.
Oh, yeah.
And so
yeah.
They were thinking, this is what you were saying.
Yes. So, those are cultural norms, and we just need to be aware of them.
Can you make the same comment about
India. I've spent time in India, but I don't know if I can. They're certainly not Japanese. Everybody doing something different, and there's a lot of commotion. I don't think I know Indian culture well enough. Does anybody know Indian culture well enough to make a comment about it? I should. I have to ask my daughter-in-law. She's Indian, so I'll ask her tonight when I see her. Yeah.
I think your talk was very interesting, that you kind of walked the tightrope with self. And I could see my life experience of going to both extremes. And so what you were saying, I don't feel like I don't feel like I feel it could go either way. You're like the antidote to self, no self. The antidote to no self, self.
That's right.
It's like we're not. We're not solidified ego.
Right. So this is the middle way in the Nagarjunian sense, in which the middle way includes both ends. It's not the middle in between. Well, it's in between two. Right. Yeah.
Isn't there like a kind of a order or a direction that goes? I mean, yeah, I agree that.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
I mean, like, you know, first you know, a person develops just that sense of self, even though it's not kind of thing, before they can even disidentify with it.
That's right. That's right. And that's the way Ken Wilber talks about it. That's his approach. And that makes sense. But it's not completely linear either. So I would just even take that with a grain of salt.
But the development is linear.
Yeah, but it's also circular and spirals and regresses. Yeah, yes, to a degree. Yes, to a degree. Wait till I get senile, and you'll see what I'm talking about. You gonna hang around that long?
I want to go back to Stacy's question.
Okay.
And observe that really, I feel like what you were talking about with the characters from the dream world or Oz are here. right? What's up with that? And it's really what you were talking about the whole time. Anything that you construct is a fiction. A constructive non-self is just as much a fictional non-self as a fictional self. And so you go, at the end of the movie, she wakes up from the dream. And who's there? People from the dream. What's real? What's real? Uh-huh. Pay attention. This is it.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. Okay, on that, thank you very much.